Remy glanced at him. A helicopter would be nice right about now, along with a small army. We have 2 guns, Sam said. We're going to have to make do. You think you could bluff your way past those people? She studied the couple arriving at the door, the tuxedo-clad man handing his invitation to the guard. That depends. Next step in the plan? You get in. Then find a way I can get in. Great plan, Fargo. I was hoping for something a little more specific. He lowered the binoculars. A place that size. We need a little recon inside so we know where to go once we're in there. You realize we're dressed like burglars. Isn't your dress still in the back of the car? My dress, yes. But what about shoes? Dazzle them with your beauty, Sam replied. Who'll notice what you were wearing on your feet? Except every woman in there. Unless they're carrying guns, they're not the ones I'm worried about. Trust me, Remy, I've seen that gown on you. There's not a man in that house who will be looking at your shoes. You're expecting me to walk in there without more of this plan in place? I didn't marry you just for your looks. That was a happy bonus. Chapter 48. In the years that Selma Wondrash had worked for the Fargos, she'd gotten used to the sometimes odd requests they made, never mind the long stretches of working without a day or night off for weeks at a time, and the more often than not 24-hour access the Fargos needed, whether they were volunteering their time for a search-and-rescue operation, or they were on the hunt for a lost treasure. That they paid her an exorbitant salary to compensate for this time made little difference in Selma's life except to say that she could retire today and not have to worry about how she'd survive. The truth was, even if they weren't paying her, she'd do it for free. They were more like family than employers, and she knew they felt the same about her, which was why this sudden inability to get in touch with them troubled her. Perhaps it was because she was 20 years older than the Fargos, but she likened the experience to what parents must feel like when they can't reach their kids by phone and they didn't know where they are. The hardest part of waiting was the unbidden imagining of all the terrible things that might have befallen them, especially in the Fargos' world, which was why she was staring at the phone on her desk, tapping her fingers. Laszlo, sitting at his desk next to her, said, "They'll call. You know how they are when they're in the middle of something. Usually a jungle or some desert island. Except they're in Italy, where there's a surprising lack of jungles or desert islands, and they're on their way to a function probably filled with mafioso running a fencing operation for fine art." "Right up their alley," he said. "You know as well as I that they're loving every second. Why, I have no idea, but they do. What if something happened, and that's why they're not calling? We could start a used car lot with a number of rental cars they've ruined. Those two are in enough near disasters that I've had to start coloring the gray in my hair." He looked up at the short spikes on her head. "I quite like what you've done. Those bits of blue and pink." When she felt her face heat up, she turned away, pretending to concentrate on the missing journal that Albert's attorney had overnighted to her, as though she was suddenly worried about losing her place. It wasn't all that long ago that Laszlo had come to work for the Fargos full-time as a cryptographer and researcher. Looking back, she realized that she, a workaholic, and Laszlo, a recovering alcoholic, had done a fairly good job of tolerating each other's presence. Somewhere along the way, she'd lightened up, and he'd sobered up. Of course, it wasn't long after that they'd discovered they actually worked well together. She liked his dry sense of humor, and he liked her work ethic. More importantly, they both liked the Fargos. That, in her mind, made for a good professional relationship. Lately, though, she was starting to discover that there was more to Laszlo than met the eye. He'd taken the time to learn about her late husband, an Air Force test pilot. He knew she liked Pink Lady apples over Fuji, and when the going got tough, and she was deep into research and tempted to raid the pantry upstairs for a quick snack instead of a meal, he took to the kitchen, his intent to make sure she ate right. He wasn't the best chef in the world, but he'd bought a Hungarian cookbook, and his attempts to make goulash, stuffed cabbage rolls, and paprika chicken with dumplings were endearing, even if the dishes were a bit overcooked. She stole a glance in his direction, grateful to see he wasn't looking at her, and hoping he didn't notice her embarrassment. He did, however, notice her sudden attention. "You know you want to," he said, without looking up from the pages on his desk. Shocked, speechless, Selma wondered for a moment if he'd been reading her mind instead of his copy of the Viscount's journal. This time there was no hiding the color flooding to her cheeks. "I don't know what you're talking about," she said, trying to focus on the book. "Ringing the Fargos," he replied, giving a pointed look at the phone. "While I'm quite sure they'll ring if they need something, you've been staring at the same page in that journal for the last several minutes. It's clear you won't be able to concentrate until you pick up the phone." He looked over at her, seemed to do a double take. "You're not coming down with a fever, are you?" He reached over and touched her forehead, his skin cool against hers. "You do feel a bit warm." "I'm fine," she said, scooting her chair back to put some much-needed distance between them. Slipping a piece of paper into the journal to mark her place, she picked up the receiver, punching the speed dial for Sam's phone. Nothing. Not even a beep. She hit the hook flash, trying for a dial tone. "I don't think it's working." Laszlo picked up the phone on his desk, got the same result. "I dare say. That explains why we haven't heard from them. I'll call the phone company and get a technician out here." The relief she felt, knowing there was a reasonable explanation, disappeared when they discovered that their cell phones weren't working either. Laszlo was staring at his iPhone screen, waiting for it to reboot. "Quite coincidental, wouldn't you say?" "Suspicious is more like it," she said, turning to the computer and realizing the internet was down. "If it was just the landline and internet, I could almost believe it's bad phone lines. But cell phones, too. You don't think someone hacked the Fargo accounts?" "Let's hope not," she said. But after a quick trip to their closest neighbor to make a call unsuccessfully to the Fargos, then trying to get a technician out to fix the lines, there was no question about it. Someone had not only closed all the Fargo accounts, they were denying them access. She called the bank next and discovered that those accounts had been frozen as well. As much as Selma worried about the Fargos being out there without any money or way to contact them, she knew that her employers were resourceful. The Fargos would discover a way to get in touch. Of that, she had no doubt. And when they did, they'd be expecting answers to the history on the Grey Ghost. What she needed to do was finish her research. But when she sat down to read the stolen journal, she discovered her bookmark had slipped out. "What else can go wrong?" she said, turning the pages. "Allow me," Laszlo said, taking the journal from her, quickly finding her place. Chapter 49. Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Welswick, 1906. I awoke to splitting pain in my head and the vague sensation that I was being watched. I cracked open one eye, moonlight surrounding me, as I tried to recall how it was I'd ended up on the ground behind some tavern next to a rubbish heap. A voice from above startled me. I looked up, seeing nothing but the silhouette of something large and round. A cow with wings? No. A man with his hands on his hips. In the dim light coming from an open door, I realized it was a barkeep staring down at me, a stern expression on his face. "I have no idea how I got here," I said. "One too many points, I'd say." "That's just it. I don't remember drinking more than a glass of wine at dinner." The bartender grunted in disbelief as I sat up, trying to remember the circumstances that brought me here. I'd had dinner with Miss Atwater. When I tried to stand on my own, a wave of dizziness came over me. "Can't hold your ale, eh?" the man said, catching me. It was easier not to argue with him. Lucky I heard the ruckus out here, he continued, taking a step back once I was safely on my feet. I looked around, trying to remember what happened. The sight of my father's brass-handled cane, shoved into the trash heap next to us, brought with it the vague memory of someone calling me Lord High and Mighty as they threw me on the ground. I turned to the barkeep. I appreciate your help. Seems to me a gentleman such as yourself might offer a reward for saving your neck. He held out his hand, demanding payment. Those blokes might have slit your throat, had I not walked back here when I did. At great risk to myself, I might add. Grateful, I felt in my coin pocket, surprised to discover money still there. Relief turned to fear as I recalled Miss Atwater's sudden disappearance. Did you see a lady with them? Was anyone talking about a woman? Don't rightly know. You said you heard the ruckus. Think carefully, man. What did you hear? When a look of suspicion crossed his face, I pulled out several coins. Tell me exactly what you heard. He eyed the money, then me. One bloke said he knew you'd follow the water. The other two laughed. A fresh wave of nausea struck me as I thought of Miss Atwater, frightened and alone. What else? They dumped you here and said to meet in 40 or 50. Were they actually discussing time, or could it have been something else? The man eyed me as though the question was absurd. Don't rightly know. Just that when they saw me walking out here, the first man said to leave you where you were, that you wouldn't have the guts to go after them. Had it simply been the Grey Ghost or the coveted 40-50 engine, I would have been content to call a night watchman and be done with it. But the realization that they'd taken the innocent Miss Atwater spurred me to action. I knew, though, that I couldn't go after her on my own. I need to get a message to someone. The man grabbed the coins from my palm and turned back toward the tavern, giving the refuse heap a wide berth. Funny how you toffs think I've got nothing but time. Got a business to run here. I'll pay double what I've given you. He stopped at the door, looking back at me. Triple, and I'll send a lad round. Triple, then. To Mr. Isaac Bell at the Midland Hotel. Tell him Miss Atwater's been kidnapped and to meet me. Meet where? I realized the location was never mentioned. Still, if it really was Reggie behind all this, there was only one place he'd go. Meet at my father's warehouse. The same message to Byron, Lord Riderton. I gave him the address. The barkeep muttered something about men who couldn't hold their drink as he started to walk away. Stomach roiling from the stench of the garbage and the blow to my head, I grabbed my father's cane from the refuse pile, breathing in the fresher air, trying to gain back my equilibrium. 40-50. Only one meaning behind that phrase, and not something that some cutthroat might have knowledge about. I pictured my father's warehouse, wondering how I hadn't thought of it before. Perhaps my reluctance was because I'd refused to believe that Reginald was guilty of stealing the Grey Ghost. Now that I knew it was he, it really was the only place the car could be hidden. The stolen car, however, was the last thing I worried about. Miss Atwater. During the 15 minutes it took for me to clear my head, find the right direction and walk to the warehouse, I prayed I wasn't too late. Chapter 50. Remy waited until darkness shrouded the Italian countryside before changing in the back seat of the car. She stepped out, smoothing the silk gown down her legs, then adjusted the plunging sweetheart neckline, embellished with a tiny rosette made of Swarovski crystals. Elegant, yet simple. Sam gave a soft whistle when he saw her. I was right. You look amazing. Right down to my feet. The gown was meant to be floor-length and worn with heels. She lifted the hem, revealing her black lace-up hiking boots. Like I said, no one will be looking at your feet. Walk in like you own the place. Wish me luck. She leaned over, kissed him, checked to make sure no one was watching before she made her way to the motorized cart the guards were using to shuttle the guests from the parking lot to the villa's front gate. Sam was right. No one noticed her feet. Even so, she was careful to keep her boots tucked beneath her gown on the ride over. The shuttle stopped at a wide path paved with terracotta tiles, potted cypresses spaced evenly on either side. It led to the first flight of stairs cut into the hillside, and a landing where stone benches lined the travertine balustrade, perhaps to give the guests a place to rest before they tackled the longer second flight up to the massive front doors, which were standing open to allow the guests entry. Remy walked up the path and stood at the bottom of the stairs, eyeing a few guests on the first landing, dismayed to see Luca, sitting on a bench at the landing of the first flight, smoking a cigarette, waiting for her and Sam. Bluffing her way into the party was one thing. Getting past him, something else altogether. "You look lost." She turned to see a man standing where no one had been a moment before. He wasn't a guard, since he was clearly dressed for the party, the cut of his jacket impeccable, the sheen of the cloth saying money was no object. She put him in his late 30s, though his brown hair was peppered with gray. He regarded her with a mix of curiosity and wariness, almost mirroring what she felt at the moment. Her instincts told her that being an American at this event might make her far too noticeable. "Parla italiano?" "Sorry, no. English only." She looked up the stairs, saw Luca looking at her. Not sure if he'd sound the alarm or demand his fee, she stepped into the shadows of one of the cypresses. Apparently the man standing next to her noticed. "You might consider using the lift." He waved to his left, where she saw the narrow door to the elevator cut into the rock, a few potted cypresses positioned to make it look less noticeable. "Quicker," he said, reaching over, pressing the button. The door slid open with a quiet whoosh, and he reached out, holding it so it wouldn't close on her. "Grazie," Remy said, smiling. In her best Italian-accented English, she added, "You are very kind." She stepped on, expecting him to let go of the door. But he stood there a moment, looking out toward the path. A younger man, wearing a gray suit, no tie, his shirt open at the collar, carrying a slim briefcase in his right hand, ran up. "You're late," the man standing next to her said. "Sorry, took a wrong turn." He handed over the briefcase and, without another word, turned and left. Out of the three levels on the control panel, the top one could only be accessed with a key. He pressed the first button, and a moment later the elevator rose. When the door slid open, he held it for her. Remy, grateful that he seemed to be in a hurry, moved to the side, allowing him to pass her as he exited. He gave a polite nod to her, quiet grazie, then strode off toward the front doors, clutching the briefcase in his hand. Sadly, Luca, the man she'd hoped to avoid, had definitely noticed her presence, taking the steps up two at a time. He blocked her way, his back to the house. "Where do you think you're going?" "Looking for my husband," she said, keeping her voice low. "He came up with the briefcase maybe 10 minutes ago. I broke the heel of my shoe and had to go back to the car to change," she said, lifting her gown so that he could see the toes of her boots. "You're expecting me to believe that he let you walk back to the car alone?" "Since we were late, we worried we'd miss you. He was right here by the elevator when I left him. Surely you must have seen him if you were waiting." Lucas studied her face as though trying to gauge her truthfulness. "I wasn't watching the elevator," he finally said. "Is it possible he somehow got in without you?" He looked back toward the door, past the man checking invitations, then down toward the parking area, spying the few late stragglers walking from their cars to the shuttle. Remy followed his gaze, grateful that Sam was well hidden behind the oleanders. "Possibly," he said. "I say we go in and look. He has to be here somewhere." She started toward the door. Luca hesitated, then followed her, handing his invitation to the guard, who looked it over, waved them in. What had appeared to be the entrance to the house was actually a wide veranda, with a view of the rolling hills and the lights of Rome in the distance. On their left was an open kitchen where the caterers worked. On their right, A wide travertine staircase led up to what was most likely the main living quarters, which formed a U-shape around the veranda. Numerous doors on that level opened out to the wide balcony overlooking the lower veranda. That, unfortunately, left a lot of real estate when trying to figure out the best place to enter. She and Luca moved away from the entry, Luca searching for Sam, Remy pretending to. The conversations she heard sounded like every other fundraiser she'd been to. The value of a certain stock. Who was wearing what designer? Who was divorcing whom? The one thing she didn't hear was anyone talking about cars, classic or otherwise. Odd, she thought, until it occurred to her that the party was probably a convenient cover for an auction that was dealing in stolen cars. She was about to ask Luca if that was the case when she noticed the man she'd ridden the elevator with walking toward the stairs, with the assurance of one who knew where he was going. He stopped as two men, looking like linebackers in expensive suits, blocked his entrance. Whatever he said or showed to them, they immediately stood to the side, allowing him to pass. "Who's that walking up the stairs?" Remy asked. Luca looked that direction. "Probably one of the buyers. They're the only ones allowed up there. It's all prearranged." She watched the door at the top open and the man step in. The door started to close, but not before she caught a glimpse of another guard, this one blonde with a goatee inside the door, patting the man's jacket and pockets, searching for weapons. Prearranged? How? He looked away so quickly, Remy became suspicious. She moved so that he'd have no choice but to face her. How were you going to get Sam in if it was prearranged? I wasn't. The truth is, I don't even have access. This is as far as I've ever gotten. Did you really think you were going to get away with taking our money? The look of guilt on his face told her everything she needed to know. I think our business here is done, she said. You still owe me the entrance fee. Several seconds ticked by while Remy contained her fury. Taking a calm breath, she leaned in close, whispering, I'd like to see you try to collect it. His jaw dropped. Remy plucked a flute of champagne from the tray of a passing waiter, tempted to toss it on him. Instead, walked to the balustrade that overlooked the sweeping stretch of manicured lawn surrounded by a high stucco wall, the moonlight gleaming off the deadly glass shards topping it. Chapter 51. Sam, hidden behind the oleanders, kept his binoculars focused on the palatial building while he examined the six floor-to-ceiling windows, each with two potted cypresses set on a Juliet balcony, barely wide enough to fit them. The only security on this side of the grounds happened to be the two young men shuttling the guests and the guards at the door. He swept his eyes along the 10-foot wall surrounding the estate, not seeing any security outside the perimeter. There were a couple of cameras, however, mounted high on the corners of the house. One pointed toward the front entrance, the other toward the back. He looked for a camera aimed along the south face of the wall, but didn't see one. It was either hidden behind the line of trees growing near the wall, or someone felt it wasn't needed, due to the wall's height and glass topping it. The crunch of footsteps nearby alerted him to Remy's return. She crossed the graveled lot, circumventing the parked cars until she reached the far side, where he was hiding behind the oleanders. One look at her face told him something had gone wrong. What happened? He asked as she crouched down beside him. I think Georgia needs to cross her friend of a friend off her Christmas card list. She told him what happened. He laughed softly. How do you find that funny? You've got to love the irony. If we hadn't been hacked, he'd be up there stealing our money. Remy cracked a smile. What did you find? He asked. The party's definitely a cover, to let the high-priced buyers in without attracting notice. Any idea where they go once they're in? They entered a door on the south wing. That's all I could tell. No one's getting in without passing through heavy security. All the other guests are one level down on the veranda. That would explain why, with the exception of a few windows on the south wing, Most of the house was dark. Sam surveyed the second floor. A faint light was coming from the fourth window over, making him think it was a very small lamp, or the door to the room was open, and the light was from beyond it. He handed Remy the binoculars. Take a look. You see the light coming from the one window, second floor? Could that be it? Remy adjusted the focus. I can't be sure. It looks like the general location of the door where I saw the guy from the elevator go in. But there's a lot of windows on that floor, Sam. And I was looking in from the opposite side. One way to find out. Get a closer look myself. And what good is that going to do? It may not do any good. Then again, I might get lucky. I won't know until I get up there. Not without me. Sorry, Remy. You're not dressed for the part. She lowered the binoculars, giving Sam a look of mild annoyance. Give me 2 minutes, and I will be. The truth was, he had a bad feeling about this place, and not just because of Luca's attempt to swindle them. Maybe it was just the fact there was a lot of cash being brought in. But this broker was going to a lot of trouble to guard this auction, which would lend credence to the cars having less than stellar certificates of ownership. Someone has to stay and keep watch. Flip a coin. Winner stays here. Odds he could live with, as long as Remy lost. He took a coin from his pocket, tossed it, the dull brass gleaming in the moonlight as it spun. He caught it. Your call, he said. Heads. He opened his palm, dismayed to see that she'd won. Even so, in the time it took Remy to change her clothes, he changed his mind. She reached for the backpack and its coil of rope, but he picked it up before she could. They'd learned long ago to trust each other's instincts, and clearly this was one of those times. I have a bad feeling about this. I'm going instead. Which is why I'm going with you, she countered. If something's going to happen to you, I plan on being there. Fine, he said, slipping the straps of the backpack over his shoulders. But if anything goes wrong, you're heading back to the car and out of here. Scout's honor. Chapter 52 Sam held tight to one end of the rope, tossing the coil up and over the branch of a sycamore, catching it before it hit the ground on the other side. He tugged on the length, the limb feeling solid supporting his weight, then looked over at Remy. This is your chance to back out. You're wasting time, Fargo. He climbed up, using the other branches to balance himself as he edged his way along the limb, careful of the long, thick, pointed glass glittering below him like a deadly mosaic of colorful daggers. Remy followed, retrieving the rope and coiling it. When she reached him, he slung the coil over his shoulder and maneuvered through the tree until he was on the limb that ran parallel to the balcony. He judged the distance. There was at least 5 feet between the balustrade and the thickest part of the branch. As long as he kept his balance, he could easily make it. That wasn't the question. What worried him was if the stone balustrade was securely anchored to the balcony and would hold his weight. The thrust of his jump, followed by Remy's, would not mix well if there was any dry rot or other degradation. Maybe I should go first, Remy whispered. They were at least 20 feet from the ground. If that balcony was going down, it wasn't going to be with Remy. It'll be fine. He hoped. Remy reached out, grabbing his arm as he was about to jump. Company, she whispered. From the corner of his eye, he saw 2 security guards in black uniforms rounding the corner, walking directly toward their tree. Had it not been for Remy, Sam might have been mid-jump before he saw them. Too late to step back out of sight, he waited where he was, hoping they wouldn't look up. Unfortunately, the 2 men decided to stop beneath the tree, the taller of the guards pulling out a cigarette pack, offering one to the shorter man. Grazie, the man said, accepting a cigarette and a light. He took a deep drag while the other man held the lighter to his cigarette, his face glowing as he puffed. But instead of moving on, the 2 stood there, talking softly, their smoke drifting upward while Sam balanced on the branch, trying to look as tree-like as was humanly possible while gripping the branches above him. Remy, at least, was partially hidden behind him in the crook of the tree. A gust of wind rustled the leaves, sending tree pollen and smoke swirling around him. Sam felt a sneeze coming on, and tried to alleviate the tickle by scrunching his face and wiggling his nose. When that failed to work, he let go of one of the branches, slowly bringing his hand toward his face, pinching his nostrils. The tickle disappeared. The two men did not. They took their time smoking and laughing. At long last, the first guard dropped his cigarette in the grass and ground it out with his foot. The second guard took one last drag, then did the same, the two finally moving off to continue their patrol. Sam waited a few seconds after they rounded the opposite corner to be sure he'd given them enough time before making the jump. He caught the travertine balustrade, pulling himself up and over onto the balcony. Remy followed with her usual cat-like grace, and he caught her hands, helping her over. The balcony was just wide enough for the potted cypresses on either side of the window, but not much more. He looked for any obvious signs of an alarm, but didn't see anything. Of course, there was only one way to find out, and that was to open the window. Perhaps with the party in full swing and whatever was going on with this secret auction, the alarm, if there was one on this level, wasn't set. He peered in the window, the curtain inside parted enough to see into the darkened room. "Bedroom," he whispered. "It'll be faster if we split up." She was right, but that feeling of foreboding wouldn't leave him. Going against his instincts wasn't worth the risk to save time. "We stay together," he said. Fortunately, there was only a space of a couple of feet from one balcony to the next, and he held Remy's hand while she stepped across. She'd just swung her leg over the stone balustrade, sitting on the edge, when a light went on inside, illuminating the entire balcony. Before she had a chance to move, an audible click sounded as someone unlocked and opened the window. Chapter 53. Remy froze as the floor-to-ceiling window opened out onto the balcony. She glanced over at Sam, who quickly moved behind the cypress on the other balcony, pressing himself against the wall. When she motioned that she should return to his balcony, he shook his head. There was little she could do but wait and hope that whoever had just opened the window wasn't planning on stepping out for a better view. Trapped between the potted cypress and the balustrade, she moved back against the wall, feeling the sharp stucco at her back, her pulse pounding in her ears almost too loudly to make out the voices inside. "My apologies," a man's voice said. "The room should quickly cool off, though." Once she realized they weren't coming out, she inched closer to the cypress and the open window, peering through the spiny branches, now able to see inside the room. Two men, both wearing dark suits, their backs to the window, stood near a massive mahogany desk. "You were saying that you've already made arrangements for the car," he asked. No doubt this was the broker who'd arranged the auction. "I plan to have it shipped back to the UK," the other man said. "One question I did have. Since I've no idea how you acquired the car for the auction, we value the anonymity of our sellers as well as our buyers." "Which I more than appreciate, and not where I was going. My apologies, Signor Rent. What was your question?" "While I appreciate your guarantee that this is the 40-50 I was inquiring about, was there anything about who was the original owner? Photos, documents found in the car. Anything that will help prove the provenance?" "It's the same car. I question what good the documents, if there are any, will do. Surely you must realize that the car can't be sold on the open market." "Very aware. I have no intention of selling it." "If you don't mind my asking, what's so special about this particular vehicle?" "I value history, which is why I'd like anything that seems of significance when it comes to the car's past. We'll include everything we have on it." "I appreciate it." A barn owl swooped down from the rooftop, past the window, the wide expanse of its wings drawing the notice of both men. Remy ducked back, catching a glimpse of the buyer's face as they turned to look. The man from the elevator. "If there's nothing else," Remy heard the broker ask, "where is the car? Rather than make an extra trip, I was hoping to see it in person before I fly home. A warehouse outside of Paris, I'm afraid. Once the bank transfer is made and the funds are placed in our account, we'll contact you with the location. Not before. Surely you appreciate the position I'm in, Signore. While I believe you to be a man of your word, my commodity is not one that attracts the best of clientele. I find it safer for everyone involved to make sure all funds clear the bank before disclosing the location. And surely you appreciate my position. I don't intend to give up the funds until the car is in my possession. I suggest a compromise. The broker opened a desk drawer, took out a pen, wrote something on a pad of paper. Since there's very little either of us can do until Monday, here's the address and phone number of my Paris office. We'll meet there. You transfer the money. I'll personally take you to the car. Understand, though, that this arrangement may add a few hours to your trip. The car is kept at a secure warehouse at the shipping yard. What time on Monday? Shall we say 11 in the morning? A rather tight schedule, but I think I can work around it. I'll see you then. She heard the squeak of his chair as he rose, followed by the sound of their footsteps on the tiled floor. I hope you'll forgive me, but I do need to make an appearance with my guests. Of course. Remy inched toward the cypress, peering through as the broker ushered the other man toward the door. By Monday, you'll be able to see for yourself. As I do with all my clients, I'll personally guarantee that this is the vehicle you purchased. I promise you that I have yet to know anyone who's not had complete satisfaction. Then I'll await your call. Señor Oren, a pleasure doing business with you. And you, Mr. Rossi. Lorenzo Rossi left the door open, returned to his desk, pulled something from his pocket. A key, she realized, ducking back as he took a seat, the chair again squeaking under his weight. A few seconds later, the burly guard with the goatee entered, saying in Italian, "You should be pleased with the price he paid. Your profit from that car far exceeds the total of the other cars tonight." "Very pleased," Lorenzo said, "and curious. The only reason someone makes a bid that high is to ensure no one else will even bother." "Did he say why?" "History," Lorenzo replied. "He was asking about supporting documents and anxious to see the car before the money cleared. Between that and the price he paid, I find my curiosity aroused. Maybe we should take another look at the car before we turn it over to him." "Not a bad idea." He gave a tired sigh. "Time to play host." The other man stopped suddenly, turned, and walked to the balcony, reaching out to close the window, his arm so close Remy could see the faint gray pinstriping on the sleeve of his suit coat. She held her breath. One look in her direction, he'd be able to see her on the other side of the cypress. Chapter 54. Sam raised his Smith & Wesson, aiming toward the adjoining balcony as someone reached out the window, the man's arm coming perilously close to his wife's head. Finger on the trigger, he pressed lightly, ready, should the unthinkable happen. "Leave it open," a voice called out. "I'll be coming back up to put away the buy-in once I make the rounds downstairs. It gets stuffy up here otherwise." The arm disappeared inside, and Sam lifted his finger from the trigger, breathing evenly now that the immediate danger had passed. A moment later, Remy looked over at him. "They're gone," she said quietly. He stepped out, checking to make sure the grounds below were clear before crossing over to her. "Reader's Digest version," she said. "Definitely the right auction. The broker sold the car to someone, but I didn't quite get the name. The car's being held somewhere in Paris until the money clears. They never mentioned Grey Ghost, but they did say 40-50. They give any indication they'd be back up here? After he makes the rounds of the party downstairs." Sam peered into the darkened office. "Let's take a quick look before they get back." He went first, gun drawn, just to make sure it was clear, Remy following. The first thing he checked was the door, listening for any sign of movement outside. Nothing.
I think he locked it,
Remy whispered. At least it sounded like it. He tried turning the knob. It held tight. Advantage? Theirs. They'd hear a key in the lock. He returned to the window, looking out, the moonlight angling onto the balcony. The security they'd seen earlier hadn't reappeared. Last thing he and Remy needed was for some guard to suddenly become astute and notice the dim lights of burglars in their employer's office. He pulled the curtains, returned to Remy's side, slipping his backpack from his shoulder and taking out a very slim LED flashlight, which he handed to Remy. She at least saw and heard what went on, which meant if anyone should be conducting the search, it was Remy. I'll keep watch. She started going through the desk drawers, finding one of them locked. It took her a minute to pick it, and she pulled out papers, looking them over, trying to replace them as she found them. Sam heard footsteps outside in the hallway. He held up his hand, aiming his gun at the door. Remy stopped her searching, watching him. He kept his focus on the bottom of the door, the thin line of light unbroken, until a shadow filled the gap. Then moved past. He signaled to Remy, who moved from the desk, to look over the shelves behind it.
Nothing, she whispered. If he has anything in here about where this place is.
They'd already stayed longer than was comfortable. Anything more and they were pushing their luck. Wrap it up. We need to get out of here. She nodded. While he returned his attention to the door, she gave the room a slow perusal, picking up the pad of paper and ripping off several sheets, which she put in her pocket. Her attention landed on the phone. Suddenly she picked it up, punched in a number on the keypad.
What are you doing? Trying to call Selma.
She listened for a moment, hung up.
Busy.
Again?
That bothered him. There has to be some way to reach her, she said.
If they were hacked, all Selma's information, including her cell phone and their house phone, was compromised. Selma appeared on all of their credit reports as an authorized user. Time to figure out that later. Hearing voices in the hallway, he pointed toward the window. She nodded, starting that direction. Suddenly she stopped, looking on a shelf, eyeing the books behind the desk. Clearly something about them bothered her, because she started touching and pressing them. A soft click, and a secret panel opened.
Sam, I think I found the buy-in he needed to take care of.
His gun trained on the door, he backed toward her, looking at the hidden cupboard. And on the shelf within, Remy's little blue light shining on the stacks of banded euros in denominations of 20. A little negligent, leaving money out where anyone could get it. And a quandary. He and Remy prided themselves on their honesty. Stealing something that didn't belong to them was not an option. But having been hacked and suddenly cut off from even the smallest source of income made the find extremely tempting. They looked at each other, both ready to back off, until Remy said, "We could really use that right now." Maybe so, but it's a good way to make someone really mad.
He's a broker selling stolen cars. Who's he going to call? The police?
Good point. He handed her his backpack. She unzipped it, picked up several stacks, stuffed them into the bag.
It was risky.
Someone was bound to notice the missing money. He heard footsteps in the hallway. The thin bead of light beneath the door was broken by the shadow of someone stepping in front of it. Unlike last time, this shadow didn't move on. Sam aimed toward the door and backed toward the window. Reaching behind him, he pulled open the curtain.
Remy,
he whispered, as someone inserted a key into the door lock. She closed the panel, zipped the backpack shut, tossing it to Sam as she moved to the window. She'd no sooner stepped out onto the balcony than the door opened and the broker walked in. The man stared at Sam, almost as though he couldn't believe that someone was standing in his office. His gaze flicked to the now closed hidden panel, then Sam's gun.
Guards!
Chapter 55.
Guards!
The broker cried again, his voice carrying out the window. Sam clambered over to the next balcony, When he reached Remy's side, he eyed the limb 5 feet away, then the ground 20 feet below. "After you," he said, taking her hand, helping her up onto the stone balustrade. She made the leap as easily as a gymnast, her foot landing on the thick branch, balancing lightly as she caught the branches overhead to steady herself. She quickly edged toward the tree's trunk. The broker shouted that he'd been robbed. Sam holstered his weapon, hopped up onto the balustrade, and jumped just as two guards burst out onto the balcony. Remy already had her gun out. She fired. The left cypress's pot exploded, the evergreen tilting across the balcony as the two guards ducked back inside. One of the guards inched out again. Crack! Remy killed the other pot. She fired at the balustrade, keeping the guards pinned inside as Sam maneuvered his way through the tree branches. When he reached her, he took her gun, gave her the rope. She slung the coil over her shoulder, balancing in the crook of the tree as a shout came from below. The two perimeter guards exploded from around the corner, one of them aiming his gun upward, searching the row of trees. Sam wrapped his left arm around the trunk, leaned out, and fired at the grass in front of them. Grass and dirt blasted up. The men jumped back. Sam, shifting his weight, fired at the balcony. He used the momentum to pivot around, landing on the other side of the trunk. Remy looped the rope around the branch and was already halfway down. Sam ducked when the guards from the balcony fired, shots hitting the thick tree limbs, splinters and sap flying out. Remy jumped to the ground. Sam tossed the gun to her, grabbed the rope, then jumped too, as a second volley of shots hit the tree. At the bottom, he took her hand, and the two raced to the oleanders. When they reached the car, they crouched behind it, Sam rising high enough to peer through the window. Guests on the top terrace near the front doors were leaning over the balcony, trying to see what was happening. The guard up there was drawing them away, trying to usher them toward the doors. The two young men working the shuttle were surveying the parking lot. A few cars were rolling slowly toward them. One of the men pointed at the first car, saying something Sam couldn't hear. The other nodded, walked up to the car, his hand reaching for his hip, probably for a gun hidden beneath his jacket as he looked in the window. He waved the first car through, but stopped the second car. "How fast do you think you can change back into that gown?" Sam asked. Remy looked at the men checking the cars. "Fast enough." Staying low, she opened the back door, slid in, while Sam got behind the wheel. He started the car, hoping the two young guards were so busy searching the interior of the departing vehicles in front of them that they wouldn't notice him driving out from behind the oleanders. He checked the mirror, saw Remy shrug out of her shirt, then slip the dress over her head, pulling it down over her hips. "Ready. Your hair." She pulled out the elastic, fluffed it up. "Drive on, James." Sam idled forward. One of the two men walked toward their car, looking in the window at Sam, then over to the empty passenger seat. "Signorina," Sam said. She rolled down her window and leaned out, immediately drawing the young man's attention away from Sam. "Scusi," she said, her Italian and accent flawless. "Were those gunshots? I'm not in any danger, am I?" "No, no," the man said. "Warning shots to scare off the wolves. They come down from the hills occasionally."
"How frightening," she said, her hand going to her throat. "You're very brave to stand out here."
"It's nothing," he said, taking a step back, his stance relaxing. He waved them through the wrought iron gates. Sam, keeping his focus ahead, pulled out, then watched in the rearview mirror as the second man put his hand to his ear, obviously listening to a radioed transmission. He shouted something to his partner, and both men ran out the gates toward them. "What's wrong?" Remy asked as he hit the gas. "I think they just figured out who we are." He saw the two men run into the road, drawing their guns. "Get down!" He yanked the wheel to the left as they aimed and fired, twin muzzle blasts flashing in the dark, followed by the dull ping as one of the shots hit the car. Gas pedal floored, engine roaring, Sam sped up the hill, cresting it, blinded by the headlights of a car coming straight at them. Chapter 56. Unable to see past the glare of the oncoming car, Sam slammed on the brakes, whipping the wheel to the right, the back end fishtailing. The acrid smell of burnt rubber filled the car, then dissipated as they sped down the hill. In the mirror, he saw the red glow of the other car's taillights fading as it descended on the other side. No sign of approaching headlights. For now. Remy? Nothing but the sound of the wind rushing in her open window. Remy! Her hand came up between the seats, soon followed by the rest of her.
Sorry. Took me a moment to shove my heart back into my chest.
That little bit of driving?
The longest 10 seconds of my life.
Less than 5. He shot a look at the backpack on the front floorboard, at Remy in the rearview mirror. Any idea how much you took from that broker?
I only had time to grab 3 stacks. Bands of 1,000.
3,000 more euros than we had a few hours ago. Get the plane out of hock? With the price of fuel? We wouldn't get far. I vote we start with a cheap hotel for the night and regroup in the morning.
Finding a cheap hotel without a valid credit card turned out to be harder than they thought.
Remy gave a sigh of frustration.
We need to call Georgia. She did say she had friends in the B&B business.
It's just after midnight. A little late to try to find a working phone. Remy smiled.
This is Italy. Pick any tourist attraction and someone will have a cell phone.
Sam checked the map on the dash, made a left turn. About 6 minutes later, the lit arches of the Colosseum appeared in the distance against the black sky. He parked just up the road and the two walked down the hill. Even this late, the street in front of the amphitheater was crowded with tourists, most using their cell phones as cameras. The first few attempts to borrow a phone were met with suspicious stares, even more so when Sam offered money. Remy surveyed the crowd.
Wait here a sec.
She crossed the cobblestone street to a group of young men in their 20s clowning around while taking selfies with the Colosseum in the background. The second she approached, the 4 men stopped what they were doing, their attention on Remy and whatever she was telling them. Suddenly, there were 4 cells being handed to her. 5 minutes later, she returned with an address on a scrap of paper.
We're in luck. One of George's B&B friends has an apartment near the Trevi Fountain. He'll gladly take cash, and it's open for the next 2 days.
The location wasn't near the fountain. It was directly adjacent to it, as well as the Trevi Plaza, which was still filled with dozens upon dozens of tourists enjoying the temperate late-night air. Marco Verzino met them at the door, led them up 4 flights of stairs to the topmost corner apartment, where he unlocked the door for them.
It's warm, he said, immediately opening the floor-to-ceiling windows, one of which overlooked the Trevi Fountain, bringing in the cooler air, the rush of the water below, and the drone of voices from the people milling in the square.
A cheer erupted in the crowd. When Sam and Remy looked down, a man and woman were hugging in front of the fountain's pool as those surrounding them clapped. Remy watched for a moment, asking, "Is it always this crowded?"
Marco laughed. Roma doesn't sleep in the summer. The visitors thin out in the early morning hours, but never completely.
He held up a remote from the coffee table.
If it becomes too loud, close the windows. Air conditioning in each room.
In truth, the sounds of the fountain masked the voices, and Sam and Remy slept very well. Late the next morning, they bought prepaid cell phones and a very soft pencil, then returned to the apartment where Remy took the tip of the pencil, held it sideways, and lightly rubbed it across the pad of paper she stole from the broker's office.
Soon, an address started to appear.
Sam tried calling home. No luck. Selma and Laszlo are still offline, he said.
At least now we know where we're going in Paris.
Remy looked up from the paper to the phone Sam held. We have to assume that Selma and Laszlo are aware of the hacking by now.
I'd think they'd call Georgia, knowing that was the last place we were headed.
They placed a call to Georgia, but she hadn't heard from Selma yet.
Selma's smart, Georgia said. I'm sure she'll get in touch with me.
When she does, Sam said, give her our new cell numbers. Have her call the moment she can.
I will.
What about Chad and Oliver? Do you want me to text them your new numbers?
No, Sam replied in a hurry.
Why? Georgia asked. What's wrong?
The last thing Remy wanted to do was worry her friend unnecessarily.
Where are they?
Waiting for their train.
I gave them Marco's address and dropped them off at the station about an hour ago. Why?
The phones, Sam replied. If these people hacked ours, it's possible they hacked Oliver's and Chad's to track them. They could be leading our enemies straight to us.
Chapter 57
Selma opened her eyes, trying to clear the fog from her brain as Laszlo strode into her office, carrying a bag from their wireless provider.
We have technology, he said, holding the bag aloft.
It took a moment for her to realize she'd fallen asleep in the recliner, the journal in her lap. She'd finished it once and was on the second reading, hoping to discover what, if anything, was so important about any of the entries written in it.
Please tell me you've heard from the Fargos.
Not yet, but I did get two working mobile phones that aren't connected to any Fargo accounts. We can use them as hotspots for the laptops for the internet.
No regular internet.
That account was closed, and the poor girl trying to help me was far too confused. He handed her the bag. A new account and mobile phones were faster than trying to deal with corporate.
I don't suppose you had better luck with the banks.
The good news is, what wasn't frozen as a result of the tampering, I was able to freeze while the banks tried to straighten everything out. She pulled out one of the phones, then walked over to her desk to look up George's number. The bad news is, it also keeps the Fargos from accessing any money. Surely someone's doing something to move things along. The personal banker for their account talked to the FBI's cybersecurity division. They are opening a case, which still isn't putting money in the Fargos' pockets. I wouldn't worry too much. They're resourceful.
Selma sat at her desk, putting the phone on speaker as she made the call.
Let's hope Georgia has some idea of where they are.
Selma, Georgia said when she answered. Perfect timing. I just got off the phone with Remy. Everyone's fine.
Thank goodness, Selma said as Laszlo pulled over a chair and sat next to her. Still, she wasn't about to relax until she spoke with the Fargos personally.
We were hacked. Big time.
They figured as much. They bought a couple of cell phones this morning. If you have a pen, I'll give you the numbers and the address where they'll be staying temporarily.
Do you know how long they'll be in Rome? Selma asked after writing down the information.
Honestly, I don't. They're waiting for Chad and Oliver to meet up with them. But do call right away. I know they're anxious to speak with you.
Selma called the first number. Sam answered.
Mr. Fargo, she said, her sense of relief on hearing his voice almost overwhelming.
We're fine, Selma. How are you and Laszlo?
Keeping busy, trying to sort everything out. How'd the auction go?
Definitely the right place, Sam said. Hold on, let me get Remy. She has some names for you.
The broker was Lorenzo Rossi, Remy said. I didn't quite catch the buyer's name. It sounded like Warren, or maybe Borden.
Selma looked over at Laszlo, who immediately reached for the yellow legal pad with her notes scrawled all over it.
Last name? She asked.
I couldn't tell, Remy said. The broker had a thick accent, and I was listening outside, so I didn't have the best advantage.
There was a Reginald Oren in the journal, Selma said. Cousin to Jonathan Peyton, the Viscount's son.
Oren, Sam said.
Didn't Oliver say something about some relative making an offer on Peyton Manor?
Definitely.
And Allegra sort of brushed it off.
Selma circled the name on her notes.
This gives us a whole new angle to research, she said. Reginald Oren stole the Grey Ghost. He's mentioned prominently throughout the entire journal.
Interesting, Remy said. I haven't finished reading it.
Did you find out anything more? Sam asked Selma.
Laszlo and I are going through it a second time to see if we've missed anything.
Sam and I can give it a closer read later, Remy said. As soon as we meet up with Chad and Oliver, we'll be heading to Paris. We think the ghost might be there.
Paris, Selma said. Let me get this straight. The car was stolen from London, shipped to Paris, sold in Italy, and now this long-lost relative, Oren, is buying it?
From a high-end broker, Remy replied.
Was this a custom order? Selma asked. Maybe Oren wanted the car and paid someone to steal it.
The possibility exists, Sam said. But whoever stole the ghost from the London Motor Show would have to have had some inside knowledge about the ghost and the Peyton family.